In my experience.
Okay, welcome back to All. Hope everyone had a nice break, whether you were off in the Holy Land or stuck with me and Jerry here in Lower Merion. We actually went to the park. We actually took our kids skiing
for a couple of days.
So we did get somewhere.
Okay. I lane Torah, my bar mitzvah partially was his past job, so I'm here for that.
Happy birthday
something anniversary. Happy,
there you go. Very nice. All right, so. What I'm going to do is to split this into 2 weeks, although they'll stand independent of one another to some degree. And what I really want to pick up on the topic of rabbinic authority and all of this, and to circle back to something we've touched on, which is truth-telling in the halachic process. And what I mean by that is the following problem. What happens when, to take an example from another profession, right? For example, mention the example in medicine, when the doctor feels that by sharing certain information, it actually might be counterproductive for a patient, for the patient's family, and so on and so forth. And there are huge cracks, and there is an extensive literature about in medical ethics, about lying and truth-telling, and there have been all sorts of different opinions all over the map about that issue. And it comes up in halacha, too. Is it ever legitimate for a rabbi, for a posek, to, for the sake of the community or for the sake of an individual, to not be fully forthcoming about the reasoning for a ruling, right? This is the halacha, or not even about the halacha. Is that ever acceptable? At first glance, it sounds like a horrible, terrible thing. How could a rabbi ever be dishonest, right? That sounds like a horrible thing, and yet the Gemara has this idea that there are certain things that sometimes we say, halacha vein morin kein, which means this is the halacha, but we don't necessarily quite say it in that way. Sounds like a terrible idea, but then it's going to undermine trust in the system. And yet we have this notion. So I want to talk about this idea of transparency in the halachic system. And I think it touches on a lot of these questions, and the scandals and all of this. And transparency, I think, is really key in today's world, in the corporate world, and in personal relationships, is really essential for building a relationship. So if you want rabbis and community members to build healthy relationships, well, transparency sounds like a really key part of that. Then how can it be that the Gemara has this notion that we're not always forthcoming? That sounds very disturbing and very uncomfortable. So we're going to come to that. What I realized, though, is that in order to talk about that intelligently, we have to take a step back and think about how the rabbis approach truth-telling and lying in general. Because we can't talk about a particular case when it comes to halacha if we don't know the Torah's general view. So what I'm going to do is to spend today talking about what happens when I lie. Is it ever okay to lie? Things like that. It should be a lot of fun. And then that'll set us up for next week and say, okay, we saw last week, this is the rabbinic view with regard to lying generally. Well, what happens when it comes to the halachic process in particular? So that's going to be planned for this week and next. So I want to open today our general discussion with a question. If I were to ask you, how many times a day does the average person lie?
Twice
a day.
Taking a guess. Wild guess.
What does it depend on?
It depends on if you're home with your kids.
You told me the average person or the average
person? We lie to our children all day long.
Oh, but all day long, but we certainly do.
Okay.
You told me the average religious person or the average person?
No. American.
Probably more than that. More than twice.
Yeah.
More than twice a day.
I say 8 times a day.
8 times a day. So they've done some, so it's pretty remarkable. They've done some studies about this. And I actually gave you one example of this. So this is taken from the Huffington Post. 60% of your colleagues are lying to you. So this particular study found that, if you look in the second paragraph, that 60% of people lie during a typical 10-minute conversation, and that we average 2 to 3 lies during a 10-minute conversation. Well, how many times do we have a 10-minute conversation over the course of the day? We do the math.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
I don't think I lied.
There was another study that actually was done that said that went so far as to say people lie 150 times a day on average. That's what I did. I dropped my paper. I said, really? I mean, I get the point, but that seems a little much. But I realized this morning that actually it depends to some degree. I think we all know this, but also how do we define lying? Right? I mean, there are all sorts of, times that we kind of
stretch the truth.
Stretch, and we skirt, and, you know, we do all sorts of things. I just had this morning with my son, who's a wonderful kid. I love him dearly.
Sugarcoat.
Right, so my mother, yeah, so my oldest, Bezalel, this morning, so we have these family Hanukkah get-togethers, and we have an uncle in the family who traditionally gives all sorts of fun gifts that parents don't always appreciate, but the kids appreciate, and that's how he gets become the favorite uncle. So he always gives tubs of icing out to the kids for free for one of his Hanukkah presents, and the parents have to deal with the fallout. It becomes their problem. So my kids got their icing this year at the family Hanukkah party, and they didn't finish all in one day, so they, you know, they saved the tub. It's like, you know, people hide in their basement, you know, the freezer, you know, the cookie dough ice cream and all that. So right, so we don't, the kids don't have to hide it anywhere. They got the icing fair and square, so they keep it. They keep it in our fridge. So my kids this morning were looking for the frosting. They couldn't find it. So they immediately assumed that either I or my wife had hidden it. Didn't want our kids to have the unhealthy food and all of that, right? Pretty good assumption. So my oldest calls upstairs to my wife, whom he assumed had hidden it somewhere. See, he says as follows, right? So our middle one is Moria. So he says, Ima, Moria wants to know if you hid the icing. Moria wants to know if you hid the icing. So now, that was completely true. My daughter, Moria, wanted to know whether or not Tova had hidden the icing. It happened to also be the case that Bezalel wanted to equally to know whether or not my wife had hidden the icing. So, was he lying? He wasn't, right? He wasn't. Hey, how are you? Good. Here, take. He wasn't lying, right? But he also, right? I mean, he was sort of, right? I mean, he told a partial truth. We all tell partial truths all the time. So depending on how we define lying, we do this all the time. So if you take a look at this research.
What was the answer?
The answer was, it was actually right there on the top of the fridge where it had been the entire time. It was the same old mommy and daddy did something wrong and it wasn't true at all. Not that that ever happens, right? It's only the other way around, but okay, it was right there. What happened was the eggs were just, yeah, so of course that meant we hit it. Oh well, so the research shows that we lie on quite a regular basis, and this is an interesting article. There's tons of studies about this topic, and it's very scary to see how often we lie, even if it's not really 150 times a day. This particular article also gives recommendations for how to call people on their lies, or how to figure it out. Body language, right? What do people do? They often cover their mouths, they repeat themselves, provide too much detail, right? Because sometimes they're making up as they go along.
But they break eye contact.
Break, right? Yeah, that's a classic one.
I don't know if it's on here or not.
Well, it says they change the typical patterns of the eye movement.
Their
breathing changes. They start breathing more heavily. This is great. Fidgeting and all that. So, anyhow. So if you want, you can spend an entire day. I mean, it's a little depressing, but you can spend an entire day on the research about truth-telling and lies. But we do it all the time. That's just as a matter of fact, and perhaps religiously committed people less so than general society. Probably not all that much less. And the truth is, right, unfortunately is right. As an aside, but right, I mean, it's clear that we have serious work doing this in our community when it comes to more serious matters like business ethics and things like that. Suffice it to say. So, it, you know, these are real issues, but the truth is, you know, is lying always problematic?
No.
And are all these lies objectionable lies?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. You disagree with Immanuel Kant, you know that. I hope you're okay with that.
I can sleep at night knowing that. But, I mean, isn't there a halakha justification, which I'm sure you'll get into, that mm-hmm. if it means avoiding hurting someone's feelings?
Absolutely. Yeah, just an example.
That would be an unobjectionable lie.
Well, exactly. And then said on here, women lie more frequently, trying to make other people feel good. And I would say that's an example of that, like, not hurt someone's feelings or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Hey.
That's a corollary.
It's the corollary. Yeah. What do you think about this research?
I haven't
what? Do you see this? It says that women tend to lie so they can protect other people's reputations or feelings, right? And here, it's in the fourth paragraph. Women were more likely to lie to make the person they were talking to feel good, while men lied most often to make themselves feel better. Hmm. What do you think about that reverse chauvinism over there.
There's some truth to that.
There's some truth to that. Okay, apparently you can say it this way around.
From the people I
know. From the people that you know. Okay.
For myself, of course.
Right. Okay, so basically when women lie, it tends to be okay, and when, right, on the basis of what we said, right, when women lie, it tends to be okay, and when men lie, it tends not to be okay.
The assumption that that's a bit of a it tends to be okay means why, I didn't get the reverse.
We're going to get there.
Now I finally understand what you're saying. Like, why
of course, Jerry had, before you walked in, Jerry had suggested, it was just as a starting point, that if it's in order to avoid offending someone, that it will be permissible. And the study finds that women tend to do so to make the other person feeling. Now, not to offend someone and making them feel good might not be the same thing, right? And flattering someone, right? It depends on the case.
That's when
sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
On Yom Kippur, when Achet, there is one in there where you give someone an artificial sense of flattery, or you flatter someone artificially,
right,
and you don't really mean it.
And you're right. You're absolutely right. The rabbis speak out very harshly about flattery in general, especially in context of court cases, obviously, but beyond in life. And there are all sorts of different cases, you know, even with foreign governments. It's complicated. It really is. So, it's complicated.
Diplomacy
hard. Yeah. Good luck with a purist approach on this issue. This is just not the line of work for, right? I mean, but these are hard questions. It may be true that people are lying all the time and that we tell half-truths and all sorts of things, but not every lie is necessarily ethically objectionable. Or is it? But then where do you draw the line? And what does your society look like? What do your relationships look like? Complicated. But would we want to live in a world in which everyone always told the truth, nothing but the truth?
It would be hard.
Well, first of all, to our kids. No.
Right, yeah, that too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there also cuts both ways. It's a really complicated example, right?
That's a great example.
Right? Right. So this is a question, obviously, that bothered not only Jewish thinkers but secular thinkers as well. There is actually, interestingly enough, a long and strong tradition among philosophers opposing falsehood in all scenarios. This is actually a common view. It probably started all the way back with Aristotle. Plato disagreed, but Aristotle seemed to be a purist about this. People like St. Augustine in the Christian tradition, St. Thomas Aquinas later in the Christian tradition, and then Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant is a great philosopher with this notion he calls the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative, it's categorical, it's absolute, it's across the board, and it's an imperative. So in other words, for Kant, any ethical principle must be universally applicable in all scenarios in relationships with all people. So according to Kant, either it's okay always, or it's okay never. There's no such thing as an exception to a rule for Kant. That was the underpinning of his ethical philosophy. Categorical imperative. So he claims falsehood. You're not going to live in a world in which you say there's nothing wrong with lying. So he says it's always prohibited. There's a huge stream of thought like this. In fact, I read an article recently comparing and contrasting American and halachic approaches, legal approaches, to lawyers being permitted to lie. It's a very interesting study. And basically what the authors claim, these are rabbi lawyers, so they know both sides and practiced for their entire lives. And their claim is, and I'm not really extensively familiar with the research, but basically they say when it comes to attorney-client relationships, essentially on the books, you're basically never allowed to be dishonest in any way, shape, or form. In other words, I don't just mean lying to my clients, I also mean lying about a case with regard to my client. So in other words, what they say is that on the books, basically what it says, if my client tells me X happened, and I get up and I advocate because of my job, and I want him to win the court case, and I say that it was quite the opposite, and I create this narrative in which something else entirely happened, so that's all prohibited according to American law. The one problem with that is, right, you couldn't go into diplomacy, right? You couldn't go into law. I mean, we all know that's the job of a prosecutor, right? It doesn't work that way in the real world, right? It's very complicated. The job of an excellent, right, trial lawyer is to get up and to create a plausible, specific, detailed narrative that's in favor of my client's interests. Right? That's what I'm paid to do. Right? And maybe I don't outright lie, but I say, is it not true? And it's not only in the movies, it actually happens, I understand, right? Is it not true that on November the 13th at 7 p.m., he walked into the home brandishing the knife, right? Or whatever it might be. Okay, this stuff happens, and yes, in the famous celebrated O.J. cases and the like, but it happens in real life, in everyday life as well. So it's complicated. It's not simple. So there, but on the books, there's actually a very purist approach to lying, claim these lawyers in the American Code, and they're critical of it. They say it's not realistic. What it does is it incentivizes all of our lawyers to learn to tell lies by telling everything but an outright lie, but basically be completely dishonest, and it basically creates a system that's ethically implausible. If you create such a high standard that no one could possibly abide by it, see, you've undermined actually the entire system, because you basically incentivize people to create loopholes and to get around the truth, and a more realistic, balanced approach would be more appropriate. Right? So, for example, they say, they claim that according to, again, it's beyond my expertise, they claim that according to American federal law, for example, it's prohibited to lie as an attorney in order to save a life. Forbidden to lie in order to save a life. And that someone was actually prosecuted successfully for doing so. To me, that is the height of absurdity. It doesn't, right? Again, I'm not staking the claim. I haven't discussed this with lawyers. I'm reporting what qualified lawyers wrote in a published article. I don't know whether or not that's truly representative of the system across the board. State law, and these things are complicated. So I don't mean to say that that's the case, but if that is the case, to the extent that that's the case, it strikes me as very unusual, and that's their point. They say, you know, when it comes to confidentiality, there are all sorts of exceptions. Why is honesty different than confidentiality? Right? When it comes to confidentiality, for example, a lawyer, of course there's privilege there, but if someone's life would be in danger, so then according to federal law, it's the guidelines that are accepted by the American, by the ALA, the Lawyers Association, and there it's considered to be not only permissible but mandatory actually to break confidentiality, right? And we have this, I mean, in school settings we have this in all sorts of therapist-patient relationships. That's a very common thing. They ask the question, say, why is confidentiality different than lying? Why do we have this, you know, purist kind of approach when it comes to truth-telling, as opposed to when it comes to other areas of ethics? It doesn't really make sense. So they're very critical of this, but the truth is, this is building on a long-standing ethical tradition. There are other secular philosophers who push back, and they say, no, it's much more complicated than that, and that it's prohibited to lie, perhaps, as a general matter, but there can be legitimate exceptions to that rule. For example, does it matter whether, right, it might be relevant whether or not someone will die, or, right, a more complicated case, whether or not I will offend someone, and so on and so forth. So you have those, movements like that among secular philosophers. So what I want to come to now is, so what does the halacha have to say? So this week we're going to look at what the halacha has to say about this issue, about truth-telling, etc. And then next week we're going to say, okay, that's the general, those are the general parameters. What about when it comes to a rabbi-congregant relationship? What happens when it comes to matters of halacha? Is that the same? Is that different? At first glance, it's horrific to suggest that a rabbi could ever be anything but fully forthright when it comes to such communication. And yet when it comes to doctor-patient relationships, we look at it perhaps differently, perhaps not, lawyer client relationships, therapist, etc. So is this different? Is it the same, etc.? So that's going to be the plan. So at first glance, the Torah is purist in many regards. So for example, in the Ten Commandments, source one, or I'm just going to give a couple of instances where the Torah kind of just says, truth-telling is really, really important. That pretty much summarizes the first section of the shir. Okay, so I pretty much gave away, that was the next eight sources or so, right? So it's in the Ten Commandments. Right, that you may not bear false witness against your neighbor. That's source one. That's Shmor Chaf Yud Yimel. Okay, note though the context there. What are we talking about there?
Well, the court case. Right?
Court case. Okay, is a court case similar to everyday life?
It's true.
pew joke. My father is a lawyer. I can make any lawyer jokes I want. Just saying for the record, I know we're on being recorded, but I've earned my stripes. A court case might be conceivably viewed differently, right? So flattery, right? When I attempt to bribe an official of the court, right, that already might be criminal, as opposed to if I try to flatter or bribe someone in everyday life, that might be ethically objectionable, but I'm not sure I can be tried for that, right? When it comes to perjury and all these kinds of things, when we seek to undermine the integrity of the attempt to arrive at justice, if that is the goal, the primary goal of a court case, then one can imagine that the fact that the Torah puts us in the Ten Commandments might not necessarily indicate that in everyday life it carries that same level of stringency. Although, right, so in other words, is this about truth-telling or is this about the integrity of a legal process? And what does it mean for society when you go to court to have, that's the one, if there's one place where I expect to find truth, right, it's going to be in my courthouse. And what happens if my local courthouse is corrupt? Right? That undermines the fabric of everything in the community, everything in the society, everything in the government. And so that might be a little bit different. So the question, you know, how much that carries over. But we do find it maybe in a more general context. Shmot Chaf Gimel Zayin. This is from Parshat Mishpatim, which is very important because Parshat Mishpatim deals with matters of law. And Parshat Mishpatim is where we learn about tort law in Halakha, is derived from Parshat Mishpatim. Of course, it's a little bit different when you have oxes goring and people lighting fire to fields, and how does that carry over to car accidents, right? That's what our students ask us all the time. Rabbi, what does this have anything to do with us in 2017? 2017, I'm practicing. Okay? I haven't heard that one yet, but 2016 for sure. Right? So, you know, so the cases are different, but the principles are perhaps the same. So in that context, the Torah insists, and this is a very relevant topic, Midvar Sheker Tirchak. Right? I grew up with a... Anyone grew up with Uncle Meshi? Or,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Please? Okay.
My kids did.
I think your kids did. Thank you.
No, I thought you meant you actually have an Uncle Meshi.
Okay. Well, after the shir, anyone can stay afterward and we can do the Horitz Uncle Meshi. Right, so there's a classic song. I'm dating myself. Well, my children also listen. I think it's Uncle Maishi. Midvar Sheker Tirchak, never tell a lie. Hashem knows just what's happening. There's no reason to deny anyone.
Sounds like
this is like what I listened to in my childhood. Okay, and I can still remember it. It's either fantastic or incredibly embarrassing. Or both. There is no contradiction between those two. I can keep on going. Honesty is MS. Make sure all your words are true. Wait. So Abba, Ima, and Hashem.
Oh yes.
Will be so proud of you.
The holy.
The triumvirate. Well,
which explains Ashkenazic Jewish taste in music. When we think about the roots in our beginnings. How wonderfully
we. There you go.
As long as you don't say the Trinity and call it triumvirate, we're fine.
It's fine. No, I actually think there's a whole thing there because the Talmud says that there are three partners in the creation of a person, and I think it's actually, I think it's a polemical passage.
Oh, interesting. Oh.
Actually, I think you're right. So for another shir, and that's. But I think that there's. I mean, there are all sorts of. This is one of my favorite topics. If you understand the context of Christian-Jewish polemic and relationship, there's so many rabbinic texts and so many passages where if you say, "Oh, that's what was going on there. Yeah. That was actually, you know." So there's another example where there's one of the songs that Zmi wrote for Shabbat. It says Kel Echad Bra'ani. Ibn Ezra wrote this one, the great Sephardic medieval commentator. Which is a very unusual one. Libiyuv Sari, right? So he says, one God created me. And it's like this heavy emphasis. And like, that's nice, but like, there are all sorts of things that you could say. I imagine it's Shabbat, it's a Zemer, it's a song. You talk about how God created the world. That makes sense. But why Kel Echad? And why is it the very first, I think it was the very first stanza of the song,
it is.
One God created me. Like, what? Okay, and that's true, but it's kind of irrelevant to the point. The answer is, if you were living in Christian Spain in the 12th century, it might not be irrelevant to you. So there's this, a lot of this going around. This is fascinating to me, how it opens up new insight. Anyhow, coming back. How he got there, I have no idea. I have a friend who has an elephant theory of conversation. So this is a sort of an informal shear. He says, no, sorry, not elephant, rhinoceros, excuse me. Rhinoceros theory of conversation. So he says, if you look at a rhinoceros, it sort of it sees a target, it lowers its head, and then it sees, and it just starts running. Sometimes it hits the target, but on other occasions, it misses. But it doesn't matter, because either way, it just keeps going and going and going. Just how they're wired. So he says, conversations are like rhinoceroses. So it's not the most appealing of images, but it might be memorable as well. Okay, so midvar sheker, tirchak, right? Keep away from anything that's false. Now, what's interesting is if you take a look at the continuation, though, v'nakibit tzadik al taharog, ki lo atzik rasha, meaning do not bring death on those who are innocent and the right, for I will not acquit the wrongdoer. Acquit, meaning in context of? Presumably, right? Right, a court of law and judicial context. If that's the case, then again, it's interesting when the Torah outlaws lying, it does so perhaps twice, arguably, in context of a court of law, court case. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to see there's some dispute as to whether the prohibition, in a technical sense, is limited to courtroom case or applies more broadly. We do have one example that seems to be broader than that. This is from Parsha Kedoshim, Vayikra Perak Yud Pasuk Yud Aleph, Lo Tignovu, V'lo Tichachashu, V'lo Tishakru Ish Ba'amito. Right? Do not steal, you shall not deal deceitfully or falsely with one another. Now when you say deal deceitfully or falsely, maybe that's in general. Maybe that's at home with my kids or just around the table together.
Or maybe it's just to fellow Jews.
Okay, so that's possible because there's ba'amito, right? With your right. Okay. That requires a shear in its own right, though.
As usual, is intent an important or even an element in this conversation?
Yeah. What do you mean by intent? Meaning
the intent duplicitous, corrupt, etc.,
right.
etc.? Or is the intent
mm-hmm.
not to hurt somebody's feelings,
mm-hmm.
To save a life, etc.?
Yeah, we'll get there.
We'll get
there. Yeah, absolutely, might well be. The other thing about this is that it could be that commercial transactions are also different than everyday life.
Yeah, it seems like it's one that's more related to business with a following the stealing.
Right. Right. Yeah. No. Exactly. And Parsha Kedoshim in general, there are a number of laws that govern interpersonal commercial relationships. And again, that might be different, right? I mean, it's one thing, right? I mean, are the standards the same when we're signing a contract as in everyday life?
Well, then there's the whole thing of advertising.
Right, false advertising. So are the standards there the same? Let's say I tell false advertise all, you know, so that I don't offend my my client base, I don't know. My consumer base, I should say. I mean, it's hard. It's no. Now it's just about profit, right? But yeah, the criteria might be somewhat different. Or another way of saying it is, commercial contexts are not first and foremost about not offending someone. They're about my bottom line. So if I'm lying, it's probably for that reason. In which case, it might be problematic. So what's interesting is, on the one hand, the Torah speaks out on numerous occasions against lying, but each one might be a specialized kind of context. So there's sort of that ambiguity already sets in from the get-go. The rabbis were very insistent, with all the exceptions that we're going to see momentarily, but they spoke about truth-telling in very, very high terms, right? They held it in very high regard. Pirkei Avot, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Meir, toward the end of the first chapter, Al Shoshah Dvarim Ha'olam Ameh, the world stands upon three foundations, Al Hadin, justice, judgment, Al Ha'emet, truth-telling, but then ironically, Va'al HaShalom,
mm-hmm.
on peace.
Mm.
Right? To me, this tells the story.
Interesting.
And to me, the rabbinic story is, of course, truth-telling is incredibly important. But you know what?
Shalom.
There are lots of other things that are incredibly important. A human life is incredibly important. Peace, harmony, right, is incredibly important. Now, sometimes, ironically, the attempt to maintain healthy relationships by telling untruth can actually have the opposite effect. If it's too much embedded in our relationship, speaking of kids, right? I mean, they're perhaps the most sensitive and aware of this, right? They'll see it right away. I mean, as soon as we start getting commitments, we break them, or as soon as they pick up on it, they're all over it, right? And younger kids, adolescents, immediately they jump on it, and it can be exceedingly difficult to repair that once that's lost. Right, and that's so it's not always the case that it's clear that lying will always, in the long run, in the larger scheme of things, help to create better relationships. It may undermine them. But in exceptional circumstances where it's clearly the exception and not the rule, and does not define the fabric, the nature of the relationship, there might be cases. So to me, this is actually very profound. Truth-telling is incredibly important, but there are lots of values, and life is about sometimes balancing different values. That's constantly what we're doing, and that's what lying is really all about. I don't mean the duplicitous kind. I don't mean the business dealings. I don't mean in a court of law. I don't even mean the story I told this earlier at the beginning about my son and telling half-truths, things like that. I mean when we do it to be sensitive to someone, when we do it because we want to save face. So in the case we're going to see about the bride who's less than beautiful, and what do you say? Or do you say, well, as she is? Or do you say, oh, beautiful bride? I mean,
great,
imagine.
Personality.
What? Great
personality.
Oh, so they're going to see that, right? So, I mean, and we know people like this, by the way. There are people who are very straight about this, right? And we'll get up. I've seen rabbis also who are, and they get up and be under the chuppah and, you know, sometimes they'll say something negative, or sometimes they'll say something that's honest and forthright, but you don't have to be brilliant to read between the lines, and it doesn't always work that way. So this is, I mean, shalom and emet, these are, and we always grapple with, these are very real. But again, the rabbi is very important. Gemara in Shabbat, source 5, Chotamos Shel Kadosh Baruch Hu Amet. That's his seal. God's seal is truth. God's seal is truth. God's seal is truth. Well, if God's seal is truth, then presumably we know that there's a mitzvah to walk in God's ways, right? Imitatio Dei, to follow in the ways of the Lord. So if we're meant to follow God's path, then God is truth-telling. That's his seal. Then presumably it should be our monikers as well. It should be our bumper stickers, okay? Truth-tellers. Let's see if we can mass market them. Emily.
I think... the issue of what defines truth. Now, in Hebrew, you don't have capital letters. But in English, if I were writing this, I would make it a capital T.
Okay, so what's the distinction?
So the distinction might be, I'm speculating aloud, that God's truth includes chesed. Let's stick with chesed, which sometimes does not... involve, or on the contrary, sometimes involves not the factual truth.
Mm-hmm. So Emily is, I didn't put it on the sheet, but Emily, right. So Emily holds like one of the great 20th century Jewish philosophers. I'm serious. How about Rav Dessler?
I've heard the name.
Rav Dessler. So Rav Dessler has a 5-volume in Hebrew, Michtav Mi'Eliyahu. In English, they translate as Strive for Truth. That's good stuff. Okay, you didn't know about your Punovich connections also. That's another. Yeah. Little known. Okay. So he says this, and he says this as a way of explaining not God's truth, but human truth. And what he says is there's sort of like this. He doesn't say lowercase t, capital T, but he kind of says there's truth in the sense of the veracity or accuracy of the statements that I offered, that I made. And then there's truth in the sense of that which is of ultimate, well, really it's good, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of, truth is sort of that most closely approximately, it's that which is good. Capital G, or God's will, if you want to go, whatever it is, right? Something like that. And he says, it's not that Judaism sometimes allows one to engage in falsehood, it's that Judaism defines truth more broadly than sometimes we do in everyday conversation. So that's pretty good. The only question is it semantics? At a certain point, is it semantics?
I think it's conceptual.
Mm-hmm. It's profound.
It's just
because, right, aren't you distinguishing between like a platonic absolute truth,
mm-hmm.
the notion that there is one concept of happiness, of light, of, you know, anything that is has that super arching one truth. And this is saying that embedded in that
mm-hmm.
is, you know, some really beautiful, I mean, I think that's really
mm-hmm.
But,
right.
you know, that absolute universal truth that exists in without us, without relativism, without context, there exists this notion of a value
right.
that is beyond and outside of us, that is the thing
right.
that we seek, that we...
Right, I'm good with that, and I'm good with that idea of the platonic truth. My question is it still true if it's not factual?
What does that mean? Why don't I understand the question?
Well, I think what Dessler is saying is that sometimes I can outright lie for the sake of harmony, right?
Okay,
and that's part of, maybe that's what Emily was saying, but that's, he says that too, that's truth in the larger sense because it captures... Because it captures another value, right?
Right.
I'm just saying
the definition of truth for her would
be. Right, so that's what I'm saying.
Semantic. It has a value that would then shift the black and white. It's not an
that's
answer,
right.
right?
Truth is
something
really about, and then truth is really about that which is good.
The good.
The good. Mm-hmm. Which I'm very attracted, that's
yeah.
fine. I'm just, do you see what I'm,
yeah,
just, you kind of read the funny. Right, that's why.
Which, yeah, it's interesting.
Right. Well, that's why I was more drawn. When I heard that Rav Dessler idea, I kind of said, it may be true, but it, instead of redefining what truth is, why might we just say that Judaism believes that in life we're constantly sort of balancing different values, and that in
okay.
certain cases, and that's part of the complexity.
Okay.
It's very nice to live in a world, a Kantian world in which ethics are, right? Chad v'chalak, black and white. That's not Jewish ethics. We completely repudiate that. You know, I think that's evident from everything we'll see the rest of the shiur, but I think it's very clear that Judaism is not categorical imperative. Judaism is situational. MS is a tremendous value. Shalom is a tremendous value. They're both necessary to uphold the world. If you go too far in one direction, it's done. It's over because everyone's going to walk around and they'll say, well, I'm going to say the most offensive thing I can just for the sake of saying truth, right? Isn't this a part of what our political debates are about today also? And there might be another extreme that says, you know, I don't really care about truth, lowercase truth anymore,
right?
Right? What's most important is that people feel okay and feel good about themselves.
Right.
It's really relevant whether or not they're actually good at what I just complimented them for. And it's irrelevant whether by complimenting them for a lack of achievement, I've actually hurt their self-esteem rather than helped their self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's another extreme. And to me, Judaism is all about negotiating values, and there's no one answer. And I think that's the ingeniousness of Judaism. Sometimes it's more complicated and it's less easy, but I don't think that there's another path. I think that that's really... I think if we want to call that capital T truth, call it capital T truth. If we want to call that there are multiple values that are all divine, that God himself embodies and that we are meant to represent, and in the messiness of everyday life, we need to constantly... And there's some autonomy in that. There's some autonomy in that. I think it's part of the beauty. You can't... Not everything is a rat. Ask a rabbi a question. You know, maybe it's... You know what? In context of this relationship, MS is of tremendous value. Shalom and chesed are tremendous values.
Mm-hmm.
My child's esteem, my child's development is of a tremendous value. What's the right call? You know what? Maybe that's not a halachic question. Maybe that's using my understanding of the situation to make the best judgment that I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's actually profound in terms of a certain empowerment, legitimate empowerment within the halakhic process.
I think if you look at Islam, you find another extreme, because according to Sharia law, they have a concept called taqiyya, which you may...
I'm not familiar with that.
Now, taqiyya is a formal concept within Sharia law, which says that it's okay. Not only is it okay, but a Muslim is obligated to lie.
Mm-hmm.
If it means, number one, advancing the cause of jihad, or number two, and more generally, if it advances the interest of the ummah, which is the Muslim nation.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically gives them a free ticket to do all kinds of lying, particularly when it comes to interaction with the kuffar, which is what
mm-hmm.
we are, anyone who was an infidel, anyone who was a non-Muslim,
mm-hmm.
and there are even some secular Muslims who will be considered kuffars.
Mm-hmm.
So... So that
it's the same word, by the way,
kofar.
Right? It's a kofar.
Yeah,
oh, okay. I didn't realize the Hebrew was the same.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of perhaps this whole concept of of lying to advance a higher good or a higher purpose is unleashed in a more global sense.
This is really relevant for next week as well, because one could theoretically then say the same thing for halacha, and we don't necessarily say that. Don't think we say that, but you know, sort of, how do we negotiate this? Because as soon as it's not about the interpersonal, but it's about the system, or it's the vertical, right, that justifies all sorts of things. But on the other hand, is there really a distinction? I mean, if I care, should I care less for my commitment to God than I care for my commitment to another human being? I mean, if it's legitimate to lie in order to for the dignity of a human being, is it not legitimate to lie for the dignity of God? Not so convinced. So we're gonna. This is next week's question.
Because again, it seems to me almost. Again, these are just spontaneous responses.
Sure, and it's not like I came with the answer. These are questions I'm learning about myself.
The notion of the dignity of God precludes lying.
By definition.
By definition.
Precisely because of his divinity. As opposed to us, we're mere mortals, so we have...
Right. And by the way, I just wanted to comment that literature is fiction. Fiction, not literature, but fiction are lies in the interest of truth. And that's why it took a long time for the novel to...
Well, that's why Kant never wrote fiction.
Yeah, right.
No, but you're right. Are you suggesting that the reason that the novel started so late is perhaps for almost because it was objectionable to medievals?
Oh, absolutely.
I never thought about that. That's fascinating.
I know that historically.
What?
I know that.
You know that historically. That's absolutely fascinating.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Well, that's your theory.
That's my field, literature.
Oh, that's your field. I know it's your field. No, I know it's your field. That's why I'm asking.
So I'm just
is that your conjecture or is there?
That is not conjecture. That is not that literature started so late, because you could say that parables are tiny short stories. What I'm talking about is legitimacy of the novel. Mm-hmm. The novel was considered fluff. Okay. Now, women who have nothing to do with that.
Right. Right.
You know, the rise of the middle class and the rise of the novel. Coincide,
right.
But it wasn't taken seriously. And part
until
of the
Don Quixote. Isn't he considered the first modern novel, Don Quixote? That's what Eileen Watts tells me. She's the.
I defer to. She's probably right. I never thought of it. I'm thinking more in terms of the British tradition, but in any event, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Fascinating. Chaucer is scandalous or an outlier, not only because he's telling all sorts of tawdry tales in the whole nine yards, but the very structure itself is.
And that was considered a genre. I mean, the romances, I'm talking about medieval romances, so they were considered charming. Okay, they expressed people's desires, but myths, on the other hand, not to get too far afield, were considered truths, and drama was taken.
They were considered factual truths, though, right? Lowercase t truths. When you say myths, meaning historical truths, not like their truth
mythology,
in the sense.
You're talking about mythology, Greek mythology, Roman mythology. Those
right.
They were considered to be true. Right.
Right. I don't mean. I'm saying not truth in the larger. Yeah, right. No. In the truth. Factual
and,
sense.
And drama was taken seriously from the get-go, because dramas among the Greeks had a religious origin.
Mm-hmm.
And it dealt with such, you know, really heady themes, life and death, atonement, redemption.
About like a bunch of tales by the
But drama
the
was okay, but stories by
a bunch
or even take earlier where they get together and they leave Rome because of the Black Plague. For heaven's sake, Boccaccio. A bunch of tales. I forgot the name of them right now. But that was also considered, you know, fluff. They were telling stories to entertain themselves because they ran away from the plague. So I'm talking about legitimacy. I would suspect that the Pete Chaucer in particular, oh, he knew he was talking about truth. Much of Chaucer is social commentary.
Of course.
And so is Boccaccio, if I can just remember the name of the tales. So the authors knew that they were telling stories to reveal truths about human nature. But in terms of the cultural scheme of things, they weren't taken seriously.
Fascinating. Good. That's a helpful frame. Wow. Thank you. Very interesting. All right. So, so the rabbis clearly recognize the importance of truth. And I give you a little bit more. So if you look at the Sefer HaChinuch, he talks about Mitzvah Ayin Dalet 74 in Source 6, page 2. He talks about, he says, the root of the mitzvah, this is the prohibition against lying, Midvar Sheker Tirchak and Mishpatim, he says, the root of the mitzvah is known that falsehood is despicable and reviled in the eyes of all. There's nothing more despised than it. Scourge and curse will enter the house of any who love him, meaning it, falsehood. For God is the Lord of truth, and everything with him is truth, and blessing is only present among those who resemble him in their actions, right? So, right, so this is sort of, right, maybe I would say now a medieval, right, sort of statement.
Is that the Decameron?
Thank you.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you, yeah.
That's Google.
Yay, Professor Google.
thank you. Thank you, Jerry. Yeah, and then the Gemara Masechim, right? There are three people that God hates. There are three things that God hates. One who, right? And the first one of those is someone who's, there's a discrepancy between the outward appearance and the inner truth of that person. The Gemara goes so far to say that we're in Sanhedrin, Naftali ben Amnon, someone who lies is considered to be comparable to one who worships idolatry. Right, so that's like the boogeyman in Jewish, right? In Jewish, that's like the worst thing possible, right? You say it's like worshiping idols, right? That kind of thing. So you clearly have these statements in favor, but we know that our tradition going back to Sefer Bereishit is rife with lies. Right? I mean, isn't this the central motif of Yaakov and Esav?
Right.
But it's right before that, right? I mean, what would Kant say about, right, about when Abraham lies about his relationship with his wife in order to save her life when they go down to Egypt? Right? Say that you're my sister, he said. Is he criticized for lying? No, right? Presumably he did the right thing, right?
Aren't there a couple of...
Those who criticize him, mm-hmm, criticize him for going down to Egypt, for not having faith in that regard. But I don't think it's for that lie. And it's considered... In fact, one could argue halachically that Abraham was not only permitted to lie. If someone would ask me the question in this case, they would give me the same sort of details of the case as Abraham, I would not only say that they're permitted to lie, I would say it's absolutely mandatory to lie. It's, right? It's, yeah, saving human life. It's not even a question. Right? And by the way, right, Abraham does it twice in his career. He does it back in Gar. These, by the way, these sort of book, in addition to the story of Lech Lecha, of going to Israel or going to Canaan, and then Lech Lecha going to perform the Akedah. This is, you look, Avram's whole life is a series of sort of concentric circles. As he revisits many of the same experiences again. And sort of one way to map the maturation of Avram Avinu is how he deals with highly similar scenarios in the first and second phases of his career. So there's a whole shear in this. Rabbi Paragon, actually, who's coming to Shabbos, has a, I heard this from him maybe for the first time, but it's a very interesting way to think about Avraham's career. So he does this again, though. In this regard, he doesn't change, right? He tells the lie, he tells the lie again. And it's the same lie. Yitzchak learns to lie from his father. So Yitzchak also, by the way, experiences, we know, many of the same things as his father before. And that's kind of the point with regard to Yitzchak, that he's the lowercase conservative one, or he's firming up the tradition. There's a need for continuity. And so he sort of puts it in place and coalesces the traditions.
And you have Masei
and he's
Avot,
got the same thing.
Masei Avot Simana Levani.
Right, absolutely. So if they're doing it, so then we should, right? Okay. So you can, of course, overstate it, right? That sort of applies to anything. But absolutely, 100%. Right? And of course, Yaakov, we're going to come back to this, but I mean, right? I mean, Yaakov's an excellent liar. And he doesn't decide, doesn't even do that on his own, right? Who tells him to be, right?
His mother.
That's his mother. There is some discussion about that, but the face reading of the text again is that she did the right thing, that Yitzchak was the blind one, quote unquote, not only in a physical sense, but that he didn't fully understand the characters of whom he was dealing with. Not that he wanted to cut out Yaakov entirely, that's a mistaken reading, but that he wanted to give the Bechorah to Esav, as might be expected, because Esav was the biological firstborn. But according to Jewish tradition, the simple reading is that she was right, is that she advised Yaakov correctly. So, you know, we have his aravot or imahot. I mean, this is right. It goes way back, right? We've been liars for quite some time. So, right, the anti-Semites would be very happy about this. Yeah.
Yaakov pays for it for the rest of his life.
Oh, there's no question. Yeah. We're going to come to that. I want to talk about that a little bit. That even where it might be ethically justified, there may be a stain. There are implications, right? A person can even make the right ethical decision, but that there are ramifications nonetheless.
Well, we know that about Rachel. When Rachel hid the trafim of Lavan, supposedly she died. The fact that she died in childbirth when Binyamin was born was a punishment for having lied about not having taken.
Even though we know that,
even though she was justified in doing it,
right?
That's Midrash. Versus, I think you were talking about like actual pshat, where we see like deception coming back to Yaakov. That's like where we're trying. That's I think, you know,
that's the rabbinic tradition. That's the rabbinic
explanation to why somebody would die in childhood, because it's such a terrible thing that we need to back into it with a good explanation that will soothe the masses. So, and I don't mean that in a
no. I understand, but that's a different kind of
different framework than different. Seeing the story telling us over and over again that someone is plagued by deception in their life.
Absolutely. And then I would say that the continuity of the Jewish people is only due to these lies. I mean, right? I mean, the fact that we earn that legacy is due to these lies. I mean, we're born in that. And not, I don't want to say sin, but in lies, and that does have ramifications for
us.
I'm
not saying that.
You're right. It is, in a way, it's sort of an after-the-fact justification.
You know,
one can view it that way.
Because sometimes, you know, kids are taught without that distinction. And so then the Midrash becomes pshat.
Right.
Yes.
And then
yes.
You never remember? Like, wait, did it happen? Or did we say that's why it happened? And I that's just like
yeah, there's,
you know,
a long history of that in the day schools in this area.
Yes.
Of that issue.
I'm not speaking, you know, we don't have experience here in this local. I'm speaking kind of universally and global.
100%. Although, just to add that, even if it's not pshat, right, it might still, 100%. Right? It's part of the rabbinic tradition.
It's part of our tradition.
Right, absolutely. 100%. The Gemara points out that actually it's the forefathers who died, and it's God also who lied. And this is really remarkable. It's Gemara Yevamot. So the Gemara says that, we'll shorten time, let's read through in English quickly. Rabbi Elazar said, in the name of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, a person may edit what has been said, which is a sort of a 21st century way called saying lying. right? Edits were made. what has been said for the sake of peace. As Joseph's brother said, your father commanded before his death, please forgive. So this is very interesting. This is at the end of next week's Vayechi, right? The brothers go to Yosef and they say, before Yaakov died, he commanded that you forgive us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So there's no record of that previously. They just say it. The Gemara asserts that they were lying. Not only does the Gemara assert that they were lying, there's no indication that they did anything wrong. And in fact, this might have been an essential stage in the reconciliation and in completing the reconciliation in Yosef and his brothers. Says the Gemara, apparently it's a model that's legitimate.
Wow.
So that's yet another example. And again, that unity is going to be crucial moving forward, right? Because that remains a complicated and fractured relationship. In fact, right, there's reason to think that despite all of this, that there was no full reconciliation between the tribes. I mean, Yosef and Rachel's children in general and the other tribes, they never fully gel. And this becomes an issue. The southern and the northern kingdoms and all of this. And this is a long-standing issue, right? Shaul from Binyamin and David from Yehuda and all of that. So it continues to be an issue. Okay, so first the Gemara says it's permissible. And then Rabbi Natan comes along and says it's a mitzvah. It's commandments, what we were saying earlier. As it is written, Shmuel said, how can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me. So this is God, this is the beginning of Parag Yitzayin of Shmuel Aleph.
God comes to Shmuel, the Navi, and says to Shmuel, I'm sick and tired of you. Why? What did I do wrong? He says, why are you so obsessed with this Saul king? Lost the melucha, he's done, it's over, move on, go anoint David. That's basically what God tells him. So he says, fine, I'll go. But he says, I'm going to need to go to Shaul
and I'm going to need to engage him in conversation, explain why I need to call upon David, and what am I going to say? And so the commandment that comes to him is he's told in the continuation of the passage, we'll go tell him it's for a feast. Make up some excuse. Okay, so it's the same kind of thing. And then the Gemara says, Skol Rabbi Shmuel taught peace is so important that even God altered what was said for its sake. Right? God lied. Wow. How did God lie? Right? So just an example, perhaps. But it gives us another example, back from Bereshit again. I mean, right? Genesis is chock full of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's why it's Lahavdil, that's why it's such good literature. Right? I mean, it's right? I mean, that's it. It's your modern literature, I guess I should say. Right? He says, for at first, Sarah said, my husband is old. Afterward, when God repeats her words to Avram, it says, I am old. So this is great. This is about the story, right? This is about telling that they're going to bear children. Yeah. Oh, this is great. Can you imagine this? I mean, this is every day, right? This is great. Right? She says, right, Abraham, my husband, is old. God repeats it and says, right? Right? She says that she's old. I mean, this is, you can't, right? Isn't this good? Isn't it? Right? It says, in other words, what's the value system here? What's the value system here?
For the sake of someone else.
For the sake of someone else, of not causing offense, or maybe for the sake of healthy marital relationship, right? It's more important to lie, and this is very important. The tradition, what?
Even with Shaul, that's the...
Right, I mean, that's the future destiny.
Shaul, but, you know, as a concept of... You know,
as an overarching, that's right. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, Shaul, you know.
Absolutely, 100%. And what's interesting about this is you actually, this idea, I didn't give you a translation, shared outside in Source 15, jump for a second. This is one of the reasons that Aaron, right, that Aaron is considered so esteemed in Jewish tradition. Right now, Aaron is described as the Ohev Shalom, the Rodev Shalom, right? He's, right, and brings people together. And then that's why the Jewish people mourned him for 30 days, not unlike Moshe, right? They choose or do a full 30 days for Aaron because he was so beloved among the community. What did he do? So there's a classic passage in Avot Rabbi Natan, which is a rabbinic commentary on Pirkei Avot. And it tells a couple of stories about how Aaron would reconcile, help to reconcile people who had fought. And he would go, and there were two people who had an argument, and this happened either with regard to two friends or with regard to husband and wife, right? Who, and it was just, it was a terrible situation. So he'd go to the first one, he'd say, you know, so-and-so feels terribly about what happened and really, really wants to make this better. And he'd go to the other one and say the same thing to the other one, and they were both bald lies. I mean, he was completely inventing the entire thing, whole cloth, and then he would bring people back together, even bringing husband and wife back together. And the rabbi said, this is why he was so beloved, and this is his greatness. Mm. I mean, Aaron, according to tradition, was one of the great liars of human history. I mean, he made up the whole thing, right? But obviously what we're saying is, right, again, maybe capital T truth, or that there's a, right, or that it's a permissible and even a mitzvah to lie for legitimate other value, right, which is to bring people together. Now, that doesn't mean that once they come back together that that should be the basis for their relationship. Mm-hmm. As soon as it turns in from the exception to the rules, as soon as it's just situational to becoming the primary mode of relationships, right, not only is it ethically compromised or problematic, but the relationships are done. It's over. Right? Without trust, without honesty, no relationship can continue. Society is done with, and commercial transactions, courts of law. I mean, we know this. We see this. It's tragic. But in exceptional circumstances, it can be a mitzvah, God himself. So this is, I think, really the thrust of the tradition. It's getting late, and I want to let everyone step at a reasonable hour. So I think what I'm going to do is, there's too much, I think, now to give it enough time. So let's pause here. Let's pick this up next week. If we need to add in one more to really give this the justice that it deserves, we will. But next time, let's see some of these ethically complex circumstances. So when is it confusing? When is it not clear? What is the theory behind all of this? And what is the rabbinic approach to truth-telling? We also have a great story about a town in which a lie was never told. Truth-telling town in the Talmud. Truth-telling Talmudic town. That should be fun. And then we'll transition to the question of halachic truth-telling. Shkach.